Good evening, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 21st day of September, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Call. And to say that it's been a bad week for freedom is probably an understatement. It's been a bad week for news in the Banana Republic, and the news kind of indicates just how far we've come down that road. Let me start it off with this story, courtesy of the much-banned Paul Joseph Watson at his new venture, Summit News, about one of Big Brother's public-private, we want to be your only internet access providers, in this case, Instagram, which is now banning photos of people at gun ranges, claiming they promote violence. Yeah, really, he says, and he illustrates it with a picture posted showing Caitlin Bennett and Millie Weaver shooting firearms at a gun range, whereupon the Facebook-owned organization immediately banned them, removed the image, claimed it violated their policy on violence or dangerous organizations. What it really is political correctness gone ape, and it makes the point, again, that what's really dangerous are your God-given, once constitutionally protected rights. And yeah, that once included free speech, too. It's been a bad week for the waste stream, too. They got caught lying again, and I've lost track of how many times by this point. The New York Times, as you probably recall, we talked about it earlier in the week, was eventually forced to issue a major correction to their bogus article about more sexual misconduct by Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, after the two journalists who wrote the bogus piece failed to include, say this with me, exculpatory evidence from their own anti-Kavanaugh book, which significantly undercut their argument. And it came out later that Leland Kaiser, one of the supposed witnesses to the Christine Blasey Ford incident, the alleged assault back in the 1980s, not only now doubts that it ever happened, she was, quote, unable to corroborate it because she has no recollection of the incident in question, she told those who didn't bother to report on that comment, but now she's told other, hopefully more reliable authors, that she was threatened with being smeared if she didn't participate in their takedown. She said, quote, I was told behind the scenes that certain things could be spread about me if I didn't comply. A stunning admission, said the Federalist, of the pressure to which she was subjected by Blasey Ford's allies. Which leads me to yet another story in the same vein, also pretty nicely now debunked, in which, as Zero Hedge put it, a very smug President Trump brushed aside questions at a press conference associated with a state dinner for the Australian Prime Minister over a whistleblower complaint which reportedly involved promises made to Ukraine in exchange for an investigation into the very crooked former Vice President Joe Biden and his son's, too, associations with Ukraine, which would by now have been well known if we had an honest press. Asked about that suddenly high-profile whistleblower story, and isn't it funny, folks, that the most transparent regime in U.S. history, Obama, deep-sixed more whistleblowers that the press never cared about before than any other administration before or since? In any case, asked about that story, and describing the whistleblower as partisan, Trump said, quote, that it doesn't matter what I discussed, adding, but I'll tell you this, somebody ought to look into Joe Biden's statement, referring to the 2018 incident where Biden openly bragged about strong-arming Ukraine into firing their top prosecutor, who was leading an anti-corruption investigation into a natural gas firm on whose board Hunter Biden, his son, sat. And let me play that for you, because he does a pretty good job.
I've had conversations with many leaders. They're always appropriate. I think Scott can tell you that. Always appropriate. At the highest level, always appropriate. And anything I do, I fight for this country. I fight so strongly for this country. It's just another political hack job. That's all it is.
All right. Well, they wouldn't drop it, which prompted the following.
It doesn't matter what I discuss, but I will say this. Somebody ought to look into Joe Biden's statement because it was disgraceful, where he talked about billions of dollars that he's not giving to a certain country unless a certain prosecutor is taken off the case. So somebody ought to look into that, and you wouldn't because he's a Democrat. And the fake news doesn't look into things like that. It's a disgrace. But I had a great conversation with numerous people. I don't even know exactly who you're talking about.
And maybe they should have quit while they were ahead.
I don't know the identity of the whistleblower. I just hear it's a partisan person, meaning it comes out from another party. But I don't have any idea. But I can say that it was a totally appropriate conversation. It was actually a beautiful conversation. And this is no different than, you know, the press has had a very bad week with Justice Kavanaugh and all of those ridiculous charges and all of the mistakes made at the New York Times and other places. You've had a very bad week, and this will be better than all of them. This is another one. So keep playing it up, because you're going to look really bad when it falls. You know, I guess I'm about 22-0, and I'll keep it that way.
And since we're not yet at war with, well, whoever the latest target is, maybe Iran, but we're still waiting for that alleged evidence. In any case, I think this is a cute comment along the same lines from Bill Blaine via his morning porridge. It's turning into a bad week, too, for the credibility of Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, after the globe's third largest defense spending state was supposedly crippled by unsophisticated Houthi rebels, or was it with the likely assistance from Iran when they struck his oil infrastructure? More than a few analysts, he continues, now suspect the Houthis may have had inside assistance from a growing Saudi domestic insurgency. Well, yeah, lots of suspects, but in any event, this morning the headlines are all about how MBS is now arm-twisting rich Saudis to buy into the discredited Aramco IPO. And investors around the globe, says Blaine, are increasingly disinclined to invest in the rising political risk surrounding Saudi and MBS. They have serious doubts about any chance of objective corporate governance of Aramco, and it's broadly seen as MBS's own private little piggy bank. But such concerns clearly don't worry his wealthier subjects, says Blaine, who are apparently delighted to have been offered the opportunity to invest upwards of $100 million, maybe because the alternative was to spend some time in the basement of the luxury Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. And as one commenter suggested, it's hard to resist an equity salesman carrying a bone saw. And come to think of it, that may describe a lot of the behind-the-scenes maneuvering to see, again, if we can't kick off World War III. This time for sure. From there, we turn to one of the other things that Americans are still blissfully ignorant of, although probably not for too much longer, the coming economic meltdown. But the warning signs keep flashing. On Wednesday, the Fed's Open Market Committee announced that they were going to lower interest rates one more time, but that's about it. They did everything, in other words, but channel the spirit of Alan Greenspan and admit that, yeah, you really can't tell when there's a bubble until after it pops. So they'll just ignore all those warnings until they hear glass breaking. Michael Snyder, the Economic Collapse blog, has a bit of review of the latest Fed speak. We'll get to it in just a second. First, I want to talk about the latest warning signs, but I do like his headline to kick things off here. Why, he asks, does the Federal Reserve keep slamming on the panic button over and over again if everything is just hunky-dory? So let's start with this warning sign, which flashed for most of the week and then went solid red. And let's start with Thursday, the day after the FOMC meeting. For those hoping, begins Tyler Durden's summary, that the dollar shortage and overnight funding crunch would have eased by the third day after the GC repo rate exploded as high as 10%, we have some bad news. No, it has not. And here's the bottom line. With $83.9 billion in total bids again submitted, not only was the $75 billion daily operation again oversubscribed, but the total liquidity shortfall rose by almost $4 billion compared to Wednesday morning, meaning that once again there were one or more participants who didn't get the billions in critical liquidity they needed. And now the Fed will see a chorus of demands by everyone to either expand the size of its operations, implement that fixed operation, and or transition to POMO, permanent open market operations, a.k.a. QE, or money printing to infinity, as Powell finally, under pressure, hinted he might do on Wednesday. Meanwhile, though, funding stress remains. Which takes us to the Friday update. Zero Hedge's story begins by noting that Goldman, insider big bankster extraordinaire, now expects them to restart POMO, or permanent open market operations, bond purchases, QE, sometime in November. They give some estimates, but wait. By Friday morning, the Fed surprised market watchers, it says, who were expecting they would continue conducting only overnight repos by announcing that not only would they conduct overnight $75 billion repos every day, Monday through Thursday, October 10th, but they would also introduce two-week term repos with a total size of at least $30 billion for the first time since the last financial crisis. So they ask, what are the implications from all of that? There are several, and they're concerning. First, by expanding the plumbing arsenal from just overnight repos to at least $30 billion term repos of at least a week, the Fed is telegraphing that they're expecting the overnight repo oversubscription situation to continue indefinitely, which in turn suggests that the New York Fed, at least, is worried that the dollar funding shortage may continue. So they're expanding the toolbox. Second, though, as noted earlier, whereas overnight repo rates have now stabilized, term repo rates remain elevated. In other words, the term market is still quite choppy, and rates still remain above the Fed's so-called target. Third, the reason why the Fed was likely forced to launch term repo is because while investors have called for measures that will permanently boost reserves, like QE, the Fed has so far refrained from embarking on a longer-term solution to ease the funding stress. Meaning, in short, despite the generous use of the $75 billion overnight repo, it's still not enough. And you can probably guess by now, at least in what direction that means things are pointing. Tyler Durden puts it thusly. Since the market's now convinced that it urgently needs the Fed to restart POMOs, expect another near-death event for the repo market, sometime, probably around late October or early November, which will be the catalyst for the, well, you know, next we had to do it or else scenario. And with that, they say, QE4 will have finally arrived. Greg Hunter, USA Watchdog, interviewed analyst and entrepreneur Carl Denninger, who says the economy is, well, good for some people, not so good for others, basically meaning the top couple of percent. And asked why it is, therefore, that big money managers and investors like Ray Dalio and Mark Mobius are finally telling people to buy precious metals. Do they see the economy hitting a wall? Denninger explained, everyone sees the wall. Everyone sees the problem. The monthly Treasury statements are public. Go pull it up on a computer. It's the general ledger of the federal government, and it's terrible. The thing is, everyone knows it's terrible, and it's been terrible for a long time. It was terrible when Obama was president, and it's terrible now. The problem, he says, is that there's so much debt and leverage in the world that the whole economy could turn dramatically worse without much warning, or without much more warning than we're already getting, maybe. And he thinks we wouldn't just face a financial crisis like back in 2008, but possibly extreme social unrest, gee, do you think, given the poisonous partisan political environment. Said Denninger, quote, you need to be looking at what sort of exposure you have if everything goes down the toilet. Also, he said, we don't just have an economic calamity, we have a civil order calamity, because the people on the left want that. He talks about the candidates running for president who already are saying they'll start a civil war. They're willing, he says, to kill 15 million Americans, murder them if they don't get their way on guns. I don't know if anybody, continues Denninger, understands just how dangerous that statement is. That's a civil war. That's what's going on in Yemen right now, and look what just happened in Saudi Arabia. If you're dependent on the medical field, he said, or you have debt and a job, and you can't make it for 3 to 6 months without them, you've got a problem, and you need to do something about it, unquote. The bigger problem, folks, and we all know this, is that most people won't. Which sets us up next for Michael Snyder's comments, asking why the Fed keeps slamming on the panic button over and over again if everything is okay. What, he asks, in the world are they doing? For months, he says, the Fed's been trying to convince us publicly that the U.S. economy is strong. And Fed Chair Jerome Powell recently stated unequivocally that the, quote, Federal Reserve is not currently forecasting a recession.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Unquote. But the Fed's actions tell a completely different story. If the U.S. economy really is performing well, any economics textbook, even those in the leftist institutions, would tell you the Fed shouldn't be reducing interest rates. Cuts should be saved for times when the economy's in serious trouble, and using up all your ammunition ahead of time before a downturn is simply foolish. And yet the Federal Reserve continues to exist, the financial system is just hunky-dory, functioning normally, while meanwhile things are spinning so wildly out of control that they felt compelled to announce another overnight repurchase agreement, not just Tuesday and Wednesday, but Thursday as well. So yeah, while they try to proclaim all is well, the truth is all is not well, and we get more troubling economic news with each passing day. So, as you've already heard, the Fed cut interest rates by 0.25% for the second month in a row on Wednesday. That didn't please the president, who wanted still more. Your host can't help but think, folks, that he's finally realized that he's already stepped in it, and that if this bubble is allowed to explode now, this close to the election, he's had it. Furthermore, continues Snyder, and we've already been talking about this for 3 days now, these consecutive repo operations literally reek of desperation. And more, even mainstream analysts are beginning to suspect that the Fed is losing control. Of course, says Snyder, more and more analysts are also projecting that a new massive round of quantitative easing is inevitable at some point, and there's an increasingly good chance that they're right. And the real economy continues to deteriorate as well. Yeah, you know about the retail store closures and the like. One new survey, though, has found that a majority of U.S. CFOs now expect the economy to tumble into a new recession by the end of next year. And even CNN is reporting on the new Duke University CFO Global Business Outlook survey, showing 53% of chief financial officers expect the U.S. to enter that recession before the upcoming election. Yeah, says Snyder, most Americans are still drinking the Kool-Aid. Everything is fine, just fine. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. But according to John Williams of ShadowStats.com, and I've been talking about him and he's been talking about these numbers for years, if honest, real numbers were being used, from inflation to employment to GDP, it would show that the U.S. economy is already in a recession right now. Bottom line, the pace of deterioration is accelerating, and the Fed's going to have to hit the panic button a number of times more in the months to come. And eventually, folks, even the generally dumb public will wake up and hear that noise and wonder what's going on. I've long suggested that they won't really realize what's going on until they walk into the local Walmart, without their gun, of course, and find the shelves empty. And by then, precisely as intended, it'll be way too late. Which ought to remind Americans who studied history of the importance of self-defense and why we had a Second Amendment to begin with. Leftist socialist traitors like Robert Francis O'Rourke notwithstanding. At least he's telling you what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton wouldn't. Yeah, they really do intend to come and take your guns. From Conyers, Georgia, a rural homeowner shot and killed 3 masked teens who approached his residence in the early morning hours, armed, wearing masks, and intending to commit robbery. But their fatal mistake was they fired on the fella who shot all 3 of them dead. Clearly they failed to confirm they were in the gun-free killing zone. Said the local sheriff's department, the victims of the attempted robbery were all uninjured, but the 3 attempted robbery suspects were shot during the exchange of gunfire and succumbed to their injuries, 1 on the scene, 2 at the local hospital after being transported. There have been no charges filed in the incident, and the sheriff is saying it looks like lawful self-defense. Georgia has what's sometimes referred to as stand-your-ground laws, especially if it's truly your own ground. Back when we had a constitution, it was simply called the common law. And this comment from the Gun Owners of America may outline the most interesting and unusual aspect of this entire case. Quote, while it's not surprising that this homeowner used a semi-automatic rifle against armed home invaders, it is surprising to see CNN report it. From there we go to a really revealing story, obviously a related topic, courtesy of Tucker Carlson and Colorado Congressman Ken Buck, who understands just how anti-constitutional red flag laws are, and no, it's not just the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Ninth and Tenth, the 14th, and so on, but the very concept of property ownership in general. And he introduced an amendment to one of those abominable bills to help demonstrate that. And the logic goes something like this. Well, if you're serious about red flags, since about 80% of gun homicides are committed by gangbangers, why not red flag known gang members? And he introduced an amendment to that proposed anti-gun legislation that would apply gang databases to the red flag lists. And here's how he explained his logic to Tucker Carlson.
If it passes, it should apply to the most dangerous people in America, the most dangerous people with guns in America. Over 80% of the murders in America with guns are committed by gang members. Over 90% of the crime in America is committed by gang members. If we aren't targeting gang members, we aren't serious about gun violence in America.
Wow, that pretty well nails it. In other words, we're so concerned about gun violence that we want to red flag everybody. Well, except gang members. Oh, and except our other buddies, of course, like fellow politicians and members of the Hollywood and press elite. But all right, we know that the left considers themselves to be above the law. But still, as Tucker Carlson pointed out, how could anybody who's for red flag gun confiscation rationally be against taking guns from gang members? And here, Representative Buck cuts to the chase and points out the now no longer hidden agenda.
Well, for one thing, I think the Democrats are trying to disarm rural America. And the second thing, I think that they aren't serious about gun violence. If they were serious, they would target these particular individuals. And third, they don't trust law enforcement to create a gang database that is fair. And their really hatred for law enforcement is evident in voting down this amendment.
And in doing so, he points out the inherent contradiction here. They don't trust law enforcement when it comes to dealing with gangbangers, drug dealers, and all kinds of other truly disreputable folks, but they're more than happy to stick them on honest, God-fearing, Bible-believing, Constitution-reading, and yes, gun-owning Americans. And he pointed out that while they don't even want to use the words due process, much less talk about no-knock warrants, swatting, midnight raids, dog killing, and any remaining protections against the obvious and incredible abuses this system would provoke, he did basically say that provoke was what they're up to here.
But that's exactly what the Democrats want to do, and they will be pitting honest citizens against law enforcement, and law enforcement, in many instances, my home county, they don't want to enforce these laws.
And the congressman is right, of course. Most, if not all, of the honest law enforcement has already said they won't, because they took an oath before God to defend a constitution that these people are attempting to destroy, and thus they have become enemies domestic. But red flag confiscation has now been exposed as a vital part of driving that wedge between real Americans and those who want to turn it into something far different, including by fomenting a second civil war. So I'd like to thank Congressman Ken Buck for helping to point that out to those with eyes to see. Well, your host finds it encouraging that at least so far, World War III hasn't yet gone hot. More and more folks, of course, are waking up to the fact that they've lied to us before, over and over again, about things just like this, so why not this time? Might be the biggest untold story in this whole mess. The destabilizing impact of large-scale, mass-produced, low-cost drones. First images of crippling damage to Saudi oil production facilities are, quote, suspiciously well-placed, says a headline. So yeah, were the precision-guided missiles from Iran that somehow mysteriously evaded the multi-billion-dollar Saudi defensive capability provided by U.S. firms? Or could it have been something more along the lines of what Bill Blaine of Shard Capital suggests, courtesy of his sources? The photos of the damage and the holes made in the gas tanks look suspiciously regular and well-placed. So more than a few analysts suspect the Houthis may have had inside assistance from a growing Saudi domestic insurgency. In other words, consider the possibility of much smaller drones launched much closer to their targets by disgruntled Saudi insiders with much closer access. I'm hearkening back to a piece I actually saw over the weekend, but have been kind of thinking about and watching develop for several days. This comes from Charles Hugh Smith of Two Minds, entitled "The Black Swan is a Drone." And he suggests up front that what was once considered just possible before last weekend's event is now a low-cost proven capability, which may explain why the media and politicos don't want to talk about it at all, and as a result, the consequences are far from predictable. And after the initial panic, the president and others have been working hard to try to convince investors and consumers that all is well in the oil market. But, says Smith, the real impact here isn't on short-term oil prices, it's on asymmetric warfare. The fact that coordinated drone attacks on Saudi oil facilities is a black swan event, and if true, or even if not, it'll eventually turn out to be true, is reverberating around the world, awakening copycats and exposing the impossibility of defending against low-cost drones of the sort that anyone, well, at least for now, can still buy. He notes here, and this is the key, folks, listen carefully, most of you probably already seen this, some published estimates place the total cost of those 10 drones supposedly employed by the Yemeni Houthis in this strike at about $15,000, maybe $20,000 tops. And that's not even enough to reload training ammo for an Air Force fighter. But even if the swarm of drones and actual cost turn out to be several times that, it still makes the point. Highly capable, commercially available drones are available for around $1,200 each. You can get units that would probably do it for far less than that now, $500 to $700 or so. And here's the money quote. The attack success should be a wake-up call to everyone tasked with defending highly flammable critical infrastructure. There's really no reliable defense against a coordinated drone attack. nor is there any reliable way to distinguish between an Amazon drone delivering a package and a drone delivering a bomb. And we'll pick it up right there after the bottom of the hour break.
Did you write the book of love, and do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe in rock and roll? Can you...
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall. Cold a throne.
Welcome back. This is Mark Collin. Let's pick it up where we left off. With the low-cost drone revolution, and like any other tool, yes, it can be used by good people for real good and by evil people for the exact opposite. So, as Charles Hugh Smith says, think about it. Whatever authentication protocol could be required of drones in the future, whether it's an ID beacon or an equivalent, could be spoofed. For example, bring down an authenticated drone using nets and so forth, swap out the guidance and payload, and away it goes. Or steal the authentication codes or beacons from suppliers. Or, of course, if it's national security material we're talking here, get it off Hitler's server. Or hack an authenticated drone in flight, land it, swap out the payload. The list of spoofing-type workaround options is extensive. And now we're at a place where this is asymmetric warfare on a new scale. $20,000 worth of drones can wreak $20 million in direct damage, cause financial losses of $200 million, or maybe multiple billions, if global markets are upended. So, yeah, and you knew this was coming, didn't you? If it's impossible to defend against coordinated drone attacks and impossible to differentiate a good drone from a bad drone, remember Glenda's question to Dorothy? Are you a good drone or a bad drone? Then the only reliable defense, and this is the usual government mechanism, don't you know, is to ban drones entirely from wide swaths of territory. Achtung, you peons are not allowed to have drones. Yeah, you know, when drones are outlawed, only outlaws will have drones, and so forth. Now, at this point, your host is going to cut to the chase. Interject my own opinion here with a bit of background. First, I like drones. I can see all kinds of applications, as can most people, which is why they have been so popular of late. Out here in the middle of the boondocks, a drone could be used to check fence lines, photograph the roof and solar panels after a major snowstorm. Hey, do I need to hike up there or not? And do all kinds of things that would be, possible perhaps, but a heck of a lot harder if you couldn't just fly over territory that might be hard to get to. On the other hand, as a pilot, I have long been suspicious of what a drone could do, just like a big turkey vulture, if it hits an airplane in flight. Pilots have certainly been concerned about these issues for years now, and we all remember the debacle at Heathrow Airport a while back. All of which leads me to the real reason I want to take some time and do this story. Basically, it boils down to this. Anyone with half a brain could see that the widespread availability of drones for under $1,000, which is approximately or less than the price of a decent semi-automatic rifle, can see that with a bit of imagination, it's possible to do one hell of a lot more damage with drones than could ever be done, even in terms of mass killings, with an AR-15. Am I urging them to be banned? Absolutely, positively, of course not. I mean, really, folks, it should be obvious by now. If we didn't have a problem before, that would pretty well guarantee we would. But do remember, nothing in the Bill of Rights says the right to keep and fly drones shall not be infringed. And you can see how effective that prohibition's been at slowing them down. As Charles Hugh Smith puts it, what kind of light bulbs are going off in the minds of copycats? Doesn't take that much imagination to see the potential for mayhem, and all without even sacrificing your own life. Which takes us to another aspect of why it is that maybe we're not hearing too much about this from the waste stream. The range and payload of low-cost drones is limited. The big drones, the kind that your tax dollars pay for, can fly hundreds or thousands of miles, carry hundreds of pounds of weaponry, but those can be targeted by radar and things like conventional ground-to-air missiles. And if the Saudis in fact spend $65 billion last year on military defense spending from the USA, maybe this is an embarrassing failure, if, in fact, that's what these turned out to be. No wonder they'd rather admit defeat to a swarm of multi-million-dollar precision-guided cruise missiles than a few measly thousands of dollars worth of hobby drones. Still, though, says Charles Hugh Smith, hobby drones skimming over the rooftops or deserts or forests are difficult to shoot down, especially if the attack is coordinated to arrive from multiple directions. These small hobby drones may only carry about 3 kilograms or maybe 6 or 7 pounds, but just how much damage do you think 3 kilograms of high explosives can cause? The answer is considerable, and that's especially true if the target is flammable or lightly shielded electronics. Or, do I really need to say it, folks? Lightly shielded flesh and bone. And by the way, folks, if you look at the pictures that are now up online, I can't help but think that looks exactly like what I might have expected. And, of course, if we're talking 3 kilograms of NBC, nuclear, biological, or chemical poisons, over a parade, outdoor theater, or football stadium, well, you get the picture. And yet, folks, we've got idiots wanting to ban your AR, only because we haven't seen enough false flag drone attacks. Yet, anyway. Larger commercially available drones, continues Charles Hugh Smith, can carry up to 20 kilograms, or more than 40 pounds, more than enough explosive capacity to take out any number of targets. No doubt, he says, defense and intelligence agencies have already wargamed the potential for coordinated drone attacks, and you know darn well that's why they're spending your tax dollars to come up with really tiny small ones for things like mass assassinations, self-organizing drone hordes of hundreds or even thousands of drones overwhelming defenders with sheer numbers. By now, folks, you may have seen night demonstrations of LED drone swarms mimicking fireworks, but with a lot more capability. Imagine if they were then programmed to assassinate somebody out there in the audience. Smith goes on here to spend a lot of ink talking about the difficulty of defending against these kind of attacks. I'll concede the point. A lot of that's probably pretty obvious. The waste stream media, of course, and your host suspects, we're already seeing this, will be under permanent pressure to downplay the consequences or even possibility of such an attack. But the cat is out of the bag. The Black Swan is a drone. What was possible yesterday is now a low-cost, proven capability. And yes, what we're talking about here is called asymmetric warfare. When it gets much, much cheaper to destroy someone or something than to protect them. We continue with a few more stories. Most of the waste stream would probably prefer stay under the radar. Former American Airlines mechanic says a piece not widely covered in the waste stream, but Big League Politics talks about it, has been charged with industrial espionage, but he is tied to ISIS. Yeah, we're talking about former American Airlines mechanic Abdul Majid Maruf Ahmed Alani, age 60, charged for tampering with that jetliner at Miami International Airport over the summer. A federal judge denied him bail on Wednesday based on new evidence tying him to ISIS during a pretrial hearing. Turns out prosecutors have discovered that Alani's brother is possibly linked with the Islamic State terrorist group in Iraq, and the not-quite-terrorist himself has a history of making statements wishing harm toward non-Muslims. And it's unclear, says the piece, if this might have motivated the man to allegedly commit those acts of industrial sabotage. Yeah, the story is it had to do with a labor dispute. That doesn't sound nearly as scary, does it, when it comes to attempted mass murder? And for that reason, of course, Alani is not being charged with any actual terrorism-related crimes, just sabotaging a Boeing 737. Now, here's the funny part, folks. At American Airlines, said a spokeswoman, we have an unwavering commitment to the safety and security of our customers and team members, and we are taking this matter very seriously, unquote. Evidently not as seriously, though, as they take political correctness. As Shane Treho, author of the piece at BLP, points out, the fact that a man with apparent ties to ISIS and a history of wishing harm towards non-Muslims somehow managed to get hired by a major corporate airliner ought to raise some serious questions about just how serious their commitment is to safety. Same thing goes, obviously, for people that led him behind the lines at a supposedly oh-so-secure international airport. But there's really nothing new here now, is there? If all of this security theater was really about keeping you safe, we wouldn't have oath breakers groping little children and harassing old ladies. Well, come to think of it, they harass everybody. And let's see, how many actual terrorists have they ever caught? I think we're still up to zero, not counting this guy. Well, at least he didn't have a drone and some C4. Next item, another eyebrow-raising story, and as it turns out, for more than one reason. Leftists, says a piece from Alicia Powell, are celebrating after a black Mercedes-Benz reportedly, and there's the rub, lost control and rammed through the lobby of, well, guess where, folks? A Trump Plaza complex in New York on Tuesday evening. Footage of the incident showed a totaled vehicle with its trunk and its hood popped open, surrounded by shattered glass, as firefighters and police officers scurried in and out of the marble lobby of the 40-story luxury residential apartment complex in New Rochelle, New York, just a little bit north of Manhattan. The driver and at least two pedestrians sustained injuries after the crash, minor as they may have been, according to law enforcement. And after the crash, the driver, who claims to have blacked out from a medical condition, took a seat on a sofa and said nothing, reported CBS local coverage. As of Wednesday afternoon, authorities maintained that the collision, which happened at about 8:40 p.m., was unintentional. They haven't determined whether drugs or alcohol were involved, much less a payoff. And according to Fox News, the driver has not been publicly identified. Meanwhile, though, progressives on the far left wasted no time using the incident to showcase the extent of their hatred for the president, said Powell. MSNBC contributor Ellie Mistel, who writes for the leftist rag The Nation as well, confessed that he has to restrain himself from plowing into the Trump Plaza every time he comes through the intersection. Quote, "When you come out of the parking lot of this mall movie theater, you have to sit at a red light staring right into this lobby," he tweeted. "I've just thought about driving my car through it every time," and he puts it in caps. He doesn't do it, he says, but, you know, just. This same pundit has also previously professed that Democrats should, quote, destroy white Trump supporters so that they could be stopped from infecting everybody else. And then went on to admit that his own bigotry causes him to believe the crash was unlikely to have been accidental. And, says Alicia Powell, other Trump haters went on to express their dismay at some length that the president himself wasn't injured during the, accident. All of which brings me to the second eyebrow-raising aspect of the so-called accident, and that is the coincidence involved in the fact that just over a year ago we had something very similar, if you may recall, in the sense of a disaster, this time involving death, at a Trump namesake property. And admittedly, folks, I'm not the first to have noticed this. Several observers from the alternative media have now pointed out that if you take a look at the timing of the last one, too, it kind of stinks to high heaven. Because in April of 2018, there was another move towards World War III. This time it involved non-existent chemical weapons. Yeah, you know who. Bashar al-Assad had them, and he must have used them against people, even though we don't really have any evidence on that score either. But Trump still wouldn't pull the trigger and send in the bombers. Well, at least not until, on the 7th of April, there was a major fire to Trump property that killed a man. And within a week, amazingly, on the 14th of April, Trump violated his campaign promise and sent in the bombers. This time it was the Iranians, or so we're told, that hit a Saudi oil facility over the weekend on the 14th of September, with the oh-so-unfortunate accident that even so many leftists don't really think was an accident, because they wanted to do it themselves, just a few days later. So you have to ask, has the president gotten the message again? And if so, we better be watching over the next few days. So far, though, as of Friday, it was just sanctions to the moon, basically. The highest sanctions ever imposed, said the president. I guess we'll see if that'll pacify the deep state neocons. From there, on to the U.S. Senate, where the real traitors are no longer even trying to hide what they're up to. First, from the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, which held a hearing on Wednesday called, get this, Violence, Extremism, and Digital Responsibility. Hint, if you wear a MAGA hat, can read the Constitution, believe that Scripture matters, or are a member of one of those now increasingly disposable races, sexes, or classes, that means you. With the heads of three of America's largest socialist media titans, Gulag, Two Facebook, and Twitter, along with some other big leftist groups. And says Peter D'Ambrosca for LauraLoomer.com, what came out of the hearing should have been downright disturbing. There was a general consensus among the assembled tech overlords that so-called law enforcement must be more involved in policing the activities of you, socialist media users. In other words, instead of the figurative speech police, we'll have the literal ones. Because shadow banning and search redirection just aren't enough anymore. Said far-left Maria Cantwell from Washington, well, one of the reasons I'm definitely going to be calling on the Department of Justice to ask what more we can do in this coordination is, several years ago, Interpol, Microsoft, and others tried to address on an international basis child pornography. Now, full stop here, folks. You notice who can get away with it and who can't. Anybody among the peons who's even caught with a picture on their computer, which can be put on there without them even knowing it's there, will go to jail for far, far less than all of those that rode the Epstein Lolita Express to Sex Slave Island. Didn't need pictures of, hell, they were doing it right there. And all the videos, of course, aren't for prosecution, they're for blackmail. So let's put this in perspective. Epstein and the list of hoi polloi as long as your arm gets away with doing it with sex slaves and kids for decades. But if a peon even has a picture of what they were doing, it's off to the gulag. The problem with Cantwell's plan, says the author of Policing Speech Online, is that at least, well, so far, it's not a crime to post on any website, even 8chan, like it is to upload child pornography. So they ask, how does the DOJ plan to police non-crimes? Well, Ayn Rand answered that for us a long time ago. It's impossible to rule honest men, so what you have to do is make everything a crime and just selectively enforce it. And as I've just pointed out, that part at least is obvious. Two Facebook's head of global policy management is on board, and she said they're working to create what they call Internet no-go zones. And guess who's not going to be allowed to go? For what she described as terrorist and violent content, which of course doesn't mean at all what you think it means. It means what they say it means. No selfies at the shooting range, folks, for sure. And of course, investigative reporter Laura Loomer knows a thing or six herself about being banned. A companion story on the same subject from the Gateway Pundit reminds us that back in August of this year, Project Veritas released leaked documents from a gulag insider showing that a whole host of names, like the Gateway Pundit, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Newsbusters, American Thinker, National News, and dozens of others are being targeted, censored, blacklisted, and of course, ultimately silenced by Google, properly pronounced gulag. Cantwell, though, clearly doesn't think the police state has gone anywhere close to far enough. So she asked, what could Big Brother be doing to police the web? And hinted broadly at the answer, saying, quote, I would assume that the representatives today would be supportive, maybe helpful, maybe even financially helpful, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, in trying to address these crimes as they exist today as hate crimes on the dark side of the web, unquote. Twitter's director of public policy strategy answered that question, saying they need to work more closely to provide information to law enforcement and support interventions. And that ought to raise a red flag. And here's the problem, folks, as we've already seen. The only speech that's going to be policed here doesn't have to do with the real crimes. It has to do with the ones Big Brother wants to make crimes, and then use that to take away others of your once constitutionally protected rights. Orwell had it right in Animal Farm. Some animals really are more equal than others. And no doubt we're going to see how that works out in the months to come. And you already knew that was going to include taking away your right to defend yourself from the likes of them, especially if you said something they didn't like on socialist media. But other traitors in the Senate, and yes, now we're seeing in the White House too, have bigger plans in mind. Courtesy of Jose Nino at Big League Politics and the Daily Caller, the White House and Department of Just Us have now held meetings with multiple so-called Republican senators and Congress critters to put forward new legislation on expanding unconstitutional background checks in the mold of the abomination called the Toomey Mansion Bill. And the Daily Caller has been able to receive a copy of what they call the idea sheet that so-called leaders in the Rhino Party have been passing around, indicating that the legislation in question would expand unconstitutional prior restraint type infringement, aka background checks, to include anything and everything that they call commercially advertised, unlicensed sales. Aha! See? Yeah, it's the commerce excuse again. So you might still, technically anyway, be able to transfer what you thought was your property, but only if you can do so without telling anybody about it. Among the traitors, says the piece, Attorney General William Barr and White House Legislative Affairs Director Eric Uhland were both in attendance at Tuesday's meetings held on the Hill, and they included alleged Republicans like North Carolina Congressman Mark Meadows, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. And no doubt, folks, they heard other crap, absolute tripe, like this. Barr claims that background check legislation, no, it's not a gun control measure. It's just an infringement. Instead, they call it a tool to assist law enforcement, sick, in cracking down on gun smugglers, unquote. And that, of course, means anybody that actually thinks they had a right to keep and bear anything that Big Brother now sees as a threat to its power monopoly. And longtime deep state whore, I'm talking about the Attorney General, of course, William Barr, longtime sellout and deep state insider, who defended FBI snipers like Lon Horiuchi, first at Ruby Ridge, then Waco. Well, Barr warned the so-called Republicans that if they don't do anything in the way of infringing what's left of your God-given rights, that would embolden the Democrat base prior to the 2020 election. And what a load of absolute unmitigated, I'm going to have to bleep myself here, bullshit. And it's time we come out and say it until it registers with those who've been blind for far too long. With friends like this, folks, who needs enemies? Because we've got traitors behind the gates. Next, we turn to Switzerland, which still seems to have a vestige of the concept of freedom, and I suggest that's why this next story is particularly significant. It comes from B.N. Frank at the Activist Post under the headline, Switzerland is sick of and sick from 5G. And as a result, there's a nationwide revolt planned for this weekend, September the 21st. Swiss opposition to 5G, begins the story, is not new, and it's not even just from residents. Back in 2017, Swiss doctor Bertrand Buchs launched a petition asking for a moratorium on its installation, and since then, doctors and scientists worldwide have signed on. Because, of course, and we've talked about this many, many times over the last several years, research has determined that exposure can cause undesirable symptoms and conditions, and that's putting it really mildly. Earlier this year, Vaud, Switzerland, adopted a 5G moratorium. But regardless, 5G was installed in Geneva, where some residents immediately started suffering from exposure. And now opponents are planning a nationwide revolt. Demonstrations against the poisonous technology are due to fill the streets of Bern later this month, but already a number of cantons have been pressured to put planned construction of 5G-compatible systems on ice. National carrier Swisscom says it expects 90% of its population to be irradiated, well, no, they put it this way, to have 5G access by the end of the year, while opponents warn that 5G poses unprecedented health and environmental risks compared to anything that's ever been foisted on the public before, i.e. previous generations of mobile technology, and they're urging authorities to place a full-fledged moratorium, at least, on the ballot. And this weekend's protests are intended to pressure politicians to do just that. So your host will suggest Americans had better be paying attention. And there's no small irony in the fact that while at least a few people in Switzerland are waking up to the real man-made dangers that they face, like 5G, others are blithering idiots gathered together to protest climate change, all the while destroying what's left of their feeble and undereducated brains, pressing cell phones to their heads. Protests were supposed to take place this weekend in 150 cities around the globe, allegedly inspired by the 16-year-old airhead climate activist Greta Thunberg, or, yeah, far more likely, the far leftist funding her and pulling her strings. Trouble is, notes Zero Hedge correctly, most of them probably couldn't explain what carbon emissions even are, or why they're supposedly going to cause the end of the world just 12 years from now if their 5G iPhones don't kill them first. So tens of thousands of students have already gathered in cities across Asia and Europe for the latest global school climate strike. In Paris, says coverage, one group of so-called students protested against intensive livestock farming, despite the fact that some of them think they might need food to live. Breeding kills Earth, said their t-shirts. And what do you bet they don't know that even if they don't want to eat meat and would like to just subsist on plants instead, those plants too need, guess what, carbon dioxide to live. Oh yeah, this is education at its finest, folks. And the only good news I can find in here is that if they protest all the time instead of going to class, they might actually get less stupid eventually. Or starve, which seems like their ultimate goal either way. Here's one more related story, but I've already spent too much time on this idiocy. This comes from J.D. Hayes at Natural News. Now he says the left-wing lunatic socialist corporations, we're talking Microsoft, Gulag, and Two Facebook, etc., are losing their own left-wing lunatic employees because of the left-wing lunatic climate hysteria they've all pushed. Yeah, those who want to shadow ban you and force their bogus so-called science down your throats and won't let you provide any evidence to the contrary anyway when they get their way are planning on walking off the job this weekend as part of the non-existent man-made global warming, but they won't use those terms. They just call it climate change protest. And the irony is, were they to actually get their way and fossil fuels be outlawed, their power-hogging computer-based companies would be out of business. But let's face it, concludes J.D. Hayes, it's easier to posture and virtue signal in the name of political correctness than it is to suffer the consequences. In real life, we're betting very few of these so-called climate-conscious Googlers will actually want to live the kind of life they're advocating for others. But wait, that kind of hypocrisy is par for the course, too. So to paraphrase the prophet Hosea from Scripture, ignorance is deadly.